AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Over the next 6 months, Iran has promised not to install any more centrifuges which are used to enrich uranium, nor will it continue construction on a reactor that can produce plutonium, which is used in nuclear weapons. It's also pledged to keep enrichment and stockpiles below what's needed to build a bomb.
These are substantial limitations which will help prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Simply put, they cut off Iran's most likely paths to a bomb.
The idea of the interim agreement with the U.S. and five other nations is to use the next half year to negotiate a longer-term deal with Iran. Not everyone is happy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's made the world a much more dangerous place, and if need be, Israel will go it alone to protect its security.
We cannot and will not allow a regime that calls for the destruction of Israel to obtain the means to achieve this goal.
But Israeli President Shimon Peres, a Nobel Peace Laureate, is cautiously optimistic that today's deal could change the region. The AP has learned that the Geneva negotiations followed secret face-to-face talks between the U.S. and Iran over the past year, talks that were kept hidden from even close allies, including negotiating partners and Israel, until just 2 months ago. A weather-related chain reaction crash on a Texas Panhandle highway has killed 3 people, bringing to 8 dead as a strong storm system marches from the southwest to the southern plains. National Weather Service forecaster Brian Cordy says Thanksgiving travel could be tough in the east.
Probably on Wednesday or Thursday, we're going to see some pretty heavy snow just west of the Appalachians in that area or along the Appalachians, and then that area of snow will work northward through upper New York State and then cross into portions of New England.
Up to 2 inches of ice is in the forecast for parts of Texas through tomorrow. This is AP Radio News. Kara Smith says she was floored when she found rape kits stashed in the basement of the Robbins, Illinois Police Department building.
It hit me so strongly that every bit of evidence in there represented someone who was raped and who came for help.
Smith, who is with the Cook County Sheriff's Department, has traced back some of the more than 170 reported rapes, some dating back to the 1980s. But in many instances, the statute of limitation has run out. Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart says the failure by the mostly part-time Robbins police force to investigate the rapes and other crimes showed raging incompetence, neglect, and a lack of concern. In top 25 college football action, no problem. Top-ranked Alabama beating Chattanooga 49-0. Number 2, Florida State scored the most points in school history, thumping Idaho 80-14. Third-ranked Baylor fell from the ranks of the unbeaten, losing big 49-17 to Oklahoma State. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hi, this is Celine Dion asking you to help put an end to premature birth. I share the concerns and fears of every parent, knowing that more than 1 million babies around the world die every year simply because they didn't get enough time to grow. Let's work together for stronger, healthier babies. Visit facebook.com/worldprematurityday to find out how you can make a difference. Thank you for caring.
If talking and texting interferes with a walk down the street, imagine what might happen if you're driving. Focus on the road, not your conversation. Your brain can't do both safely. No dialing, no talking, no texting to arrive safe.
Hi, I'm Brooke Delaney.
And I'm Congressman John Delaney.
As a teen, I know not to text while driving. My dad and I ask you to focus on the road, not your conversation.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Losing more than just spare change in your laundry? By upgrading your old washer to an energy-efficient model, you can save up to $625 over the washer's lifetime. The DC Sustainable Energy Utility offers discounts and rebates on energy-efficient lighting and appliances that can save you energy and money. Last year, the DCSU served 19,000 district households through renewable and efficient energy services. Call 202-479-2222 or visit dcseu.com to start saving money and energy today.
In today's competitive job market, imagine not having the reading skills needed to even fill out an application. 90,000 adults in D.C. are considered functionally illiterate. It takes a lot for an adult to admit they can't read. It takes even more courage to do something about it. The Washington Literacy Center teaches adult learners to read, giving them options and a bright future. Please give back to the community by donating today. Go to WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org and make your much-needed charitable contribution. Changing lives through literacy. WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jeff Parks and Colin Callahan. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Joanne Wallace, who's the president and CEO of National Legal Aid and Defender Association, Jonathan Neal, the owner and president of Metropolitan Moving and Storage, Dusty Wentz, the founder and CEO of Knowledge Consulting Group, and Tony Crescenzo, who's the CEO of Intellidyne. First up is a young lady by the name of Joanne Wallace, who's the president and CEO of National Legal Aid Defender Association. What is that, Joanne?
The National Legal Aid and Defender Association is a mission-driven nonprofit that is about the business of equal justice, making sure that our justice system is fair for everyone.
Go a little further with that. How would we know you were doing it?
Okay. So NLADA's business is supporting and expanding and actually creating the public defender and civil legal aid programs across the country. And that's about making sure that people have access to counsel no matter what, how much money they have. At the end of the Pledge of Allegiance, it says, we say, you know, in liberty and justice for all. And our members make sure that that is a reality, or work to make sure that that's the case for people all across the country every day.
When was the organization founded?
In 1911, 15 legal aid programs got together and decided there needed to be a national organization that would lead the fight for equal justice in this country. A year later, NLADA was born.
So in terms of size, how big would you characterize the organization?
So we are a, as I said, mission-driven nonprofit, but a membership association. We have program members, so about 700 program members, and that represent about 10,000 individuals who represent each year millions and millions of individuals across the country.
Other than the obvious, help for people that can't necessarily afford it, why is this so important to you?
Because it is about justice, and that's my calling. At a certain point in my life, I knew that doing justice every day, supporting that, helping to make that happen, was really so much part of who I am.
At a certain point in your life, you knew that. Tell us about that certain point.
So the point when I think I understood it from an intelligence perspective was when I worked as a special education advocate in Greater Boston Legal Services, and worked to make sure that young children and teenagers really had access to the education that they deserved.
So you came into the job market as a special ed teacher or advocate?
As an advocate working with legal services attorneys.
Uh-huh.
And so at that point, it was just so clear to me that, you know, each of these individuals deserved to have an education that the law said they could have, and that the law was a critical and important tool for helping them get there.
So at that point, you decided to shift focus and go on to the legal side of things?
Yes.
Got yourself into legal school?
Yes. And in fact, originally I worked in social services. I worked for Youth Services Bureau, worked with children, and thought that that would be my trajectory. But once I saw that if you know the law, if you can use the law, the greater impact that you can have in individuals and communities, I decided that, you know, law school was the way to go.
There were a couple other experiences you told us in the green room that kind of helped you figure out that justice was really your passion.
Well, we moved to Ellington, Connecticut from Hartford, Connecticut, where I was born. Ellington is a very rural town. There were more cows than people when I lived there. And we were the first African-American family in the town. And so as a first grader, 6 years old, I couldn't wait to go to school. I don't think I was in school for more than a couple of days when I first heard my first racial slur, and it was a traumatic experience. And I felt wronged in a way that I didn't understand at that age, but you just knew that, you couldn't understand it. What did I do? This was unfair. What did I do to deserve this, to be treated like this, to be called that name? And that has never left me. I think that people really learn about justice by first experiencing injustice.
What was your response in the moment? Do you remember?
Well, at 6 years old, crying is about it, but then you just...
But a six-year-old crying, but fundamentally you made a decision at that moment, didn't you?
Fundamentally, I made a decision that I would do whatever I could so that no one had to experience what I just did. And,
wow.
Yeah.
So then what happened? How did you go about becoming accepted, or did this just continue?
My mother and father were a great influence for me, and they helped turn what could have been a horribly negative experience into a positive.
Mm-hmm.
I learned from them that you can overcome anything, that with hard work, and if you believe that you can do the impossible, you can do the impossible. And so, every day that was their message to me by how they lived their lives and the things they overcame.
So how does that... that lesson from your mom and dad show up in your leadership style today?
This is a challenging community that we support. Right now, most people don't know that, but 50 years after the landmark Supreme Court and Gideon versus Wainwright, people get convicted in this country every day without talking to a lawyer. Mm. And on the civil legal aid side, people lose their homes, lose their employment without having access to an attorney. So these are challenging times. The budgets are really tight. And so you have to look at the assets of the community and not the deficits. Look at the passion of the advocates, how hard they work. Look at the creativity that turns scarcity into more, into the ability to represent more people, into the ability to make sure that justice is done. So that that cup half full is perspective on the world is really what it is. My leadership has been about.
You also told us a story about your first interaction with the court system. Can you replay that?
Yes. If you ask my father why I decided to become a lawyer, this is the story he would tell, which is, I was stopped for a traffic offense and thought it was very unfair and decided to go fight it. I did fight it. I won. I was very jazzed by the experience. I do attribute my love of the courtroom to that moment. And
how old were you?
I was between 16 and 18. I was still in high school. Had my license for not too long.
Uh-huh.
So. I do remember that moment and that feeling and how great it felt to win that battle and, the courtroom experience. It was nice. It was fun.
So why not just be a public defender? Why have the impact at the level that you have it, the way you have it now?
Well, I was a public defender for many years, and in fact, the chief public defender for the District of Columbia at the Public Defender Service for D.C., and that was a wonderful job and an extraordinary group of individuals that I had the opportunity to work with. But at the end of the day, there is so much more that needed to be done. And, PDS in D.C. enjoys the... has standards. So, for example, they have caseloads, they have reasonable caseloads. That is not true in places across the country for many public defender offices. And on the legal aid side, there's a real scarcity of resources. And so the desire to, everyone who is accused of a crime deserves access to a counsel. Everyone who's in jeopardy of losing their livelihood or their home or have the right to an attorney to help protect their family. And so that greater impact on the national level is what brought me to NLADA.
Okay.
So what does the public not know, or what are some misconceptions about what you do?
I think what the public doesn't know on the public defense side is the fact that, despite this landmark decision that says there's a right to counsel, and despite the fact that on TV, when we're watching the crime shows and people ask for a lawyer, they get a lawyer. Well, in real life, unfortunately, in many cases, that doesn't happen across the country. Or if you are lucky enough to get a lawyer, you may get one who doesn't have the resources to actually adequately defend you. And people are pretty shocked when they hear that, but that's a truth. And on the legal aid side, many people don't understand that, in fact, there is this legal aid system that provides both legal representation and information and information to people across the country.
Is there one story that you're aware of, above all the others, that you like, that this is why I get out of bed and do this every day? One person that was helped, one thing.
Well, when I started as a young public defender, I was representing a lot of youth, juveniles, children. And, you know, the thing, it wasn't so much one client, individual client, but what I learned early on and heard from my clients is that because I was willing to fight for them, they felt like they were someone who was worth fighting for. And so hearing that from young children who really haven't often never had anybody fight for them in their lives is really something that you don't forget.
Your mom and dad aware of your success?
My mother's not with us here, but I would like to believe that even still, yes, and she does, she is, and certainly my father is. He's very proud. And
If I was interviewing him, what would he say about you?
Oh, goodness. You know, he would, he's the proud papa, but what I would say about him is that he was my inspiration every day, never let us give up, always saying that you can, you know, for us, the term "yes, you can" was popular before it was popular. Yeah.
So for a young person listening in that might be thinking about a career in law, why should they go this way?
Because every day you'll get up knowing that you're doing something worthwhile, that you're making a difference in individual lives that really, really matters.
Great. What's the website address, Joanne?
NLADA.org.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Joanne Wallace, who's the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment after this business break. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us for this segment is Hector Velez, who's the EVP of Business Development for Hire Strategy. What is Hire Strategy, Hector?
Peter, Hire Strategy is the largest locally based recruiting firm in the D.C. metro area.
So you guys are in the business of helping find people for companies.
Human capital, or hiring employers.
And what makes your company special?
I think it's a customer experience. I think we certainly have a lot of competition in the market, and our competitors may be representing the same product, if you will, but with Hire Strategy, our clients have a different value-add experience.
Mm-hmm. And what do you like most about your job?
I like the people aspect of it, that at the end of the day, we're helping employers and people create the ideal match to support their mission.
Mm-hmm. How can someone find out about you?
www.hirestrategy.com.
And by phone, how could they reach you?
703-547-6700.
And why should somebody call you instead of somebody else?
I'll keep it simple. We've been in this market 20 years. The founding partners of Hire Strategy have been together about 18 years. What that tells you is our strength, stability, and continuity. We know the D.C. market very well.
And because of that, you can help people find really good homes with really good companies.
We bring a totally consultative approach to our business versus a traditional.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Hector Velez, who's the EVP of Business Development for Hire Strategy. I'm Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks. And for this segment, we have Jonathan Neal, who's the owner and president of a company called Metropolitan Moving and Storage. What is Metropolitan Moving and Storage, Jonathan?
We are a full-service, local and long-distance moving company that handles expert, you know, packing needs. We also have short and long-term storage options for our clients, and you know, we are specifically about quality and consistency.
Everybody says that. What makes it true for you?
With us, the employees that you know we screen and train, and our ability to retain those employees. I have men on my crew that have been with me since the beginning, and you know, when we move families, two or three times, they're always amazed to see the same guys back, on their truck.
You say that with a smile on your face, like you actually enjoy it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's
what makes it fun for you?
Well, the aspect of having, the same employees. We've really developed, a good relationship with the guys. There's a lot of trust there because, we're moving extremely valuable items on a daily basis, and it's just nice to know who you have out there on the trucks.
And no offense to the people that are working for it, but these aren't highly educated folks.
That is
how do you do? How do you instill a standard of excellence in that kind of a job description?
It's the interview process with them is definitely very strategic, and we're not involved in just grabbing the first person that comes our way. I mean, as I've told a lot of people, we could be twice the size of where we are right now if we weren't concerned with, staffing our trucks with quality people. But, right. There's always the ability to get another truck, but, finding the right people to join our crews is really the main, difficulty in growth.
So you're okay with not being the biggest guy in town? It's better to be small but great?
We are. That's our strong point is, even our growth from the beginning to where we are right now, we're still able to maintain that consistency and quality product that we promised, when we first started back in 2004.
So what were you doing back in 2004 that got you the idea to start this thing?
I was just, at my end of my stint at a previous moving company, really got an urge to go off and do something different, take a risk, and start my own company with a fellow that I met at the former company I was with as well, and we joined forces, and here we are now in 2013, and we've got a great company.
Great.
So how old were you at that point, and kind of what gave you the courage to take that risk?
At that point, I was 24. The courage was mainly just to do something that, I thought I could do, and, many of my friends thought I was nuts because, moving normally is something that's in someone's family or they take over a business. I mean, I really brought a white collar aspect to an industry that's really and still is mostly a blue collar industry. So I was a lot of looks and stares from my friends when I decided that I wanted to do this.
So you told us in the green room that you had a brother and a sister who were 7 and 8 years older than you.
That's correct.
So you had a chance to kind of learn from them, and then you worked for this company, and you had a chance to learn from them. How young were you when you first realized that you could benefit from others' mistakes?
It was a very young age. I have a strong memory, and I mean, I remember times as early as 3, 4, 5 years old when I witnessed mistakes that my brothers and sisters had made, and knew that when that situation arose, whether it be 10 years down the line or a year down the line or whatever it would be, that I knew either a way around it or just a way to avoid it altogether.
So is it about being okay making mistakes, or is it about knowing who to seek out to avoid making mistakes?
I really have tried throughout my life to be very detailed, and I have a strong urge for perfection. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons we are successful is because I'm not okay with a move having a small ding here or a broken chair here, whereas some companies say as long as a few things, you should expect a few things. With us, I expect it to go seamlessly and not have any any damage. So
you told us you played a lot of sports in school and college. What do you take away from sports that helps you now?
Definitely the competitiveness, the dedication, and the discipline to make sure that you're practicing your craft, you're improving on it, and also just making sacrifices in different scenarios that, you know, some other people may not, you know, have to, you know, specifically when you're in college and, you know, you're training year round, you know, you're not able to go out and do the things that, you know, normal college students are able to do. So
you also told us that you had the real great fortune of playing for a top tier team. Is that true?
That's true. Yes.
And so you were hanging around excellence early.
Correct.
How did that rub off on you?
I mean, the feeling of, you know, being on a team that, you know, was recognized and did have, you know, elite players on it and elite coaches, you know, definitely left me with a feeling that, you know, this is somewhere I want to be in any state of life, right, you know, no matter what I'm doing. And right, that's, you know, how I've, you know, I've been striving to that, you know, as I've been growing up. And
so I asked you this as well, and I'd like to hear your answer. Is what's more true, I hate to lose or I love to win?
I would say I hate to lose, definitely.
What is it about losing that's so awful?
Just the competitiveness that I have, and, you know, that's one of the things that continues to fuel me, because, you know, we are fairly young in the game as far as moving goes, and there are few established long-term companies in our, you know, local area that we compete with on a daily basis.
So tell us about a loss that was particularly a sting and that you got better from it.
I mean, the biggest loss I would say would be specifically, you know, not a the worst loss wasn't in a game, believe it or not. It was, you know, one of the injuries that I had, you know, my second time tearing my ACL within a 12-month period. So I'd rehab back like crazy, you know, 12 months later, same injury happens again on the same day. So that was
how do you recover from something that disappointing?
Well, I actually decided to put off the surgery at that point, which was kind of discouraged at the time because I had the ability to, you know, had a college career in front of me, and, you know, I decided to put it off and, you know, wear a brace and actually play throughout that season and get the surgery at the end of the year. Yeah. So,
okay.
We heard a kind of a prove them wrong mindset. Is that part of your inspiration?
I think it's always been instilled somewhere. I'd probably have to draw on it on a few different areas, but I wouldn't be able to pinpoint one specifically at this time, but, you know, that's always been, you know, a feeling of mine. Absolutely.
So do you think your success comes from talent or hard work or both?
I would say a little of both. At this point, you know, at the time I started the company, you know, it was more hard work. And, you know, now at this point, you know, we've really, really, you know, learned, you know, I've learned the business extremely well and have, you know, great grasp on
it. So how do you spend the time as a CEO today? What's the bulk of your day look like?
At this point now, I am, you know, overseeing our sales force, just trying to stay on top of things on a daily basis and, you know, motivating my staff and making sure that they know that I'm, you know, have a beat on things, even if I'm not in the office at all times, because I'm out marketing and trying to grow our brand.
What do you know you need to get better at as a leader of the business?
I would say being a little more lenient in certain situations on, you know, the way that I, you know, I'm leading our staff. You know, there are times where I need to, you know, be more, show more appreciation and be, but, you know, that's one of the things that we.
Where do you want to be 5 years from now?
5 years from now, I would hope to still, you know, definitely be delivering the same level of service we're delivering now, and have our workforce, you know, doubled if we can achieve that in this period of time.
I mean, you're still a young guy, but up till now, what's your proudest moment been, personal or professional?
Proudest moment was a few years into our company when we, you know, got some great recognition in the Washingtonian magazine, and more recently we were made, you know, one of the 19 fastest growing company in Montgomery County, and both my parents, you know, had a conversation with me and really, you know, did come to light about their, you know, their hesitation
they were
at the time.
Proud of you.
But at this point, that was, you know, a proud moment for them as well.
What's the website address?
Website address is www.dcmetropolitanmoving.com, and that's M-O-V-I-N-G.
Great. We've been speaking with Jonathan Neal, who's the owner and president of Metropolitan Moving and Storage. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back right after this Business Spotlight.
How do you know you've retained the strongest business professionals to work with you on your business? For example, an attorney who successfully handled your type of problem, an accountant who sees the big picture, a business advisor who gets it, a real estate broker who thoroughly knows the market, a commercial insurance broker who has access to all the products, an employee benefits guru who mitigates future costs, a wealth manager who makes work optional, an understandable information technology wizard, a commercial banker with minimal covenants, an investment banker who knows the business as a relationship, a staffing specialist to help build the team, even a confidential peer group with whom to compare notes. Simply listen to Executive Leaders Radio, executiveleadersradio.com, to confidently select a business leader who serves business leaders, because nobody's interviewed more business leaders from Princeton through Northern Virginia than Executive Leaders Radio. You'll have confidence in your choice and ultimate selection of business leaders who serve business leaders.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks. And for this segment, we have a young man by the name of Dusty Wentz, who's the founder and CEO of a company called Knowledge Group. What is Knowledge Group?
Well, Knowledge Consulting Group, KCG, we are a 100% cybersecurity services firm focused mainly on the federal market. But as of 18 months ago, we opened up a practice to help commercial companies.
Tell us a little bit more about cybersecurity.
So, you know, in its simplest form, cybersecurity is a broad market now, but in its simplest form, it's we put together technologies and processes and practices that help customers protect their information. It's probably their most important asset of any organization.
When did you start the company?
Started the company on April Fool's Day of 2000.
So that's an interesting time to start a company, by the way. Why?
I just finished, well, prior to starting the company, I had been a co-founder of a company called Business Impact Systems, and we had had it for 5 years and sold it. And during between that time and starting the company, I was actually working for a market research firm while I was waiting out a non-compete, and decided that I couldn't wait any longer, that I needed to get back. I couldn't just sit behind the desk anymore. So decided to pull together what I classified as my dream team, these people I met through my 20 years of business, and pulled them together, and we started this company.
Why did they, why, without being modest, why did these people want to join you and be a part of this? Why would they leave probably successful positions and throw their hat in the ring with you?
I think they'd seen, we'd worked together in the past, most of us, and we'd built great relationships. I think they'd seen the dedication. I think they'd seen the past experience, and wanted to be something, a part of something that was bigger than just any of us individually.
And how big or small is the company today?
Today we're about 250 people.
Wow, and how's business?
Business is good. For us, we're typically used to growing at the 15-18% a year. Of course, if you deal in the federal government, there's been some uncertainty over the last 18 months. But you know, when we're still growing and when most companies are not. So we're very pleased about that. And so we're very excited about the future.
When did you know that you had to be an entrepreneur?
Well, that would go back to my grandfather. Yeah. My grandfather was a self-made man. He raised me. I was born to a 15-year-old mother. Lucky that he took my sister and I in. My grandparents did. And he himself had left high school in the 10th grade. He lied to the U.S. government, joined the Army, actually found himself at Pearl Harbor a week after boot camp. But he was a man that just started many companies on his own, and I'd watch him fail, and I'd watch him rebuild. And after I had started my career at EDS in the mid-'80s, he was very proud of me, but then one day he came to me and said, "How does it feel working for the man?" And I said, "Well, Ross Perot's a good man." And he says,
"One,
yeah,
one of the best."
One of the best. And he goes, "Well, I'm really proud that you're doing that, but at some point, when are you going to do your own thing?"
Yeah.
And that really challenged me personally.
And so you took his advice and started.
So I took his advice, and I learned as much as I could at EDS over 10 years, and I could not have had a better proving ground. So I did that, and then another gentleman asked me to come join a company, and that was the one that I was a co-founder of. So I learned that company from cradle to grave, from starting with two people to actually selling it. And I knew then I had everything I needed to know, and I'd met the people I needed to meet in order to start Knowledge Consulting Group.
There was one particular trait you took away from your grandfather relative to leadership. What was that?
In a word, is tenacity. He was a fighter. I believe he boxed in the Army, and he lived his life that way. And so to never give up, to understand that you're going to fail, but to get back up, get back in the fight, and keep plugging along. And that was the greatest thing I've learned from him.
It's watching him fall down, get back up again.
Absolutely.
Over and over.
Over and over.
So you got into his life like in a regular way around 5 or 6?
I was absolutely 5 years old.
Uh-huh. And you spent a lot of time in North Carolina.
Yes, that's what we had done.
And I understand you went to a lot of schools.
From kindergarten to high school, went to 12 different schools.
What was that experience like?
I think that was one of, although painful as a child, you're always moving, always creating new friends. It really taught me how to deal and cope with change. And I think that's one of my strongest traits today, because I believe the only constant in the world that we live in today is that there's going to be change, and you have to understand how to deal with that.
Tell us about how you get a job with EDS.
How I got my job, or
how you got a job with EDS without a college degree?
Yeah, that's right. No college degree. Working at another company with the official job title of Xerox boy. I was the guy who pushed the Xerox copies around to people. I would work at night in the data center, just pulling tapes, pulling printouts, and learning job codes, understanding MVS and how the big IBM systems ran. And then happened to go to a job fair with a friend, and there was a company, EDS, there, and they asked me what I was doing, talked to them. The next thing I know, I was on 2 or 3 interviews and ended up getting on with EDS, working in the Pentagon.
And what did they see in you that allowed you to go on this kind of progression?
That's a funny story, because they had a contract that they had difficulties with people understanding the military and being able to get around and move around a military base to deliver the services. When I was a sophomore in high school, my mother remarried to someone who was in the Air Force, so I found myself at Edwards Air Force Base living. So the military was a way of, I understood it. So that was the one part they saw. I think the other part they saw is, even without a degree, that I had the ability to learn.
Yeah.
The EDS experience, you said it taught you how to run a business, but also how to deal with customers. What's one mistake that businesses continually make in terms of how they interact with customers?
The biggest problem I see with companies is they tend to want to tell the customer what the customer needs instead of just shutting up and listening to the customer and understanding how they can help them. I see that. I actually saw that at EDS, when at the Pentagon, when you actually sit with your customer is when you actually begin to understand the pain that they go through on a daily basis. a lot of companies try to be consultants, and so they're not actually in the business. They don't actually understand the pain points. And just to come in and give them a report that says this is what you should be doing is not solving a problem.
So would you call that a relational skill or a technical skill?
I think it's relational. I think it's all people. I think we're all in the people business. Like I said, it's not about contracts. Companies don't contract to companies. Organizations contract with people. And there are people that make up those all those entities.
How would you characterize your leadership style today?
To think about that one. My leadership style is, I would call it fair.
What does fair mean to you?
I wouldn't necessarily be characterized as a drill sergeant or a dictator. And on the other hand, I'm not a complete consensus builder at the same time, but I like to look for the best in people, draw out their talents, and think of the firm first and instead of individuals. But when you do that and the company's winning, then it takes care of the people in the company.
Mm-hmm.
What do you look for when you're hiring someone? How do you know you've got the right person?
I look for those people that are competitive. It's not a mistake that we have a lot of former athletes in our company. I look for people who understand that team beats individual every day. And those are the type of people that have made up, that I surround myself with. I look for those who have the ability to teach themselves. Having a degree is great, but typically in college, at least what I tell my children is college teaches you how to learn. And those are the type of people that we look for. Mm-hmm. And our best leaders in our company are those who were highly technical but have a business acumen, can understand business and therefore understand their customers and right. How to relate to them.
Other than your grandfather, who's another important influence along the way?
It may sound crazy to some, but it's my wife. I mean, she's kept me in line. She continues to keep me in check. I know that I have an ego. she can just her ability to be calm, her ability to help me get through certain decision points. She's been an incredible influence on my life.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing I ever accomplished, I would say, was going back to finish my 2 degrees. While running the company, I had kids my children at that time were between 7th grade and late high school. I continued to coach them, wanted to be active in their lives, and at the same time, I finished my bachelor's degree and then got an MBA from George Mason University.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
My proudest moment, without a doubt, is watching my daughter walk across stage at George Mason and get her bachelor's degree, without a doubt.
That's wonderful. What's the website address, Dusty?
Website for Knowledge Consulting Group is www.knowledgecg.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dusty Wentz, founder and CEO of the Knowledge Consulting Group. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us for this segment is Kimberly Stevens, who's the business development manager of a company called CBiz. What is CBiz, Kimberly?
CBiz is a national provider of services in the areas of finance and employee benefits.
What would you say makes your company special?
The fact that we're able to bring people together across a wide spectrum of capabilities and services to provide solid solutions to our customers.
So you help your customers find people that will help them with their things that they do for their customers.
That's exactly it.
And what's the role you play with the company?
I serve as a business development manager, and in that capacity, I work to identify people who may have needs for the services that we offer. I meet with them, listen to what the issues are that they might have, and think of the people that we have in our midst to help them.
Why do you like your job?
I like it for that very reason. I enjoy meeting people and getting to know what their business is and working to connect them with people who can help them meet their goals.
It's what makes you so good at it?
What is helpful is that I genuinely care. Mm. And I do want them to have success in their business. And I'm also very excited about the talent and capabilities that we have to offer. And so since I'm able to believe in that and care about the outcome, it helps me to be effective in what I do.
Great. And I understand somebody who would be interested to reach you could find you at www.cbiz.com-midatlantic.com. Is that true?
That's correct.
Okay. We've been speaking with Kimberly Stevens, who's the business development manager for a company called CBiz. And I'm Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined with my co-host, Colin Callahan and Jeff Parks. For this segment, we have a young man by the name of Tony Crescenzo, the CEO of Intellidyne, Inc. Did I get that right, Tony?
You did.
What is Intellidyne?
Intellidyne is a government systems integrator focusing on the enterprise. We provide IT solutions to large-scale government mission-critical situations.
When was the company founded?
In 1998.
And how big or small is it today?
We're about 300 people.
And you're the CEO?
I am the CEO.
When did you join the organization?
I joined the organization in August of 2011 as the chief operating officer and became the CEO this year.
Mm-hmm. And how's it going as the CEO?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Why did you want to be a part of this company?
Well, it's an interesting organization. Great people. Great leadership. The founder is a charismatic, inspirational figure, started the business by himself 13 years ago, built it into a really great organization with good people and lots of potential. I joined it to help realize the potential.
And are you from a long line of successful business people in your family?
I am from a family of entrepreneurs. My grandfather started our family business. My father, my uncles, my cousins are all in that business.
What's the business?
They're automobile mechanics, and they own some real estate that goes along with that.
And why not you go that way?
Well, because when I was 13, my father took me aside one day and said, Anthony, it's a good thing you're smart, because if you had to make a living with your hands, you'd starve. So I thought college was probably the better route for me.
And when did you become entrepreneurial?
I became entrepreneur as a child. I think I had a job at least one day a week since I was 8 years old. I worked delivering meat for the local butcher. I worked in my father's garage every Saturday. And I had a few entrepreneurial activities along the way.
Did you have to do that or you wanted to do that?
I come from a large Italian family from South Philadelphia. I'm not sure choice was involved in the beginning, but it becomes fun once you figure out how it works.
What was fun about it?
Being able to figure out how to get from one place to another, how to sort of make things happen that were going to result in some money in your pocket. Sure.
So if look back across time, what do you think you were learning as a kid that helped you get here today?
Well, I think it's what most successful business people learn. It's really how to relate to people, how to tell a good story, how to get people interested in what you're, not just what you're selling, but what you're saying. You always sell yourself first.
You told us about your time in the Marine Corps. Tell us a little bit about that.
I served in the Marine Corps for 8 years.
Why did you want to go in?
Because my stepfather was a career naval officer, a Navy captain, and when you're young and you want to spite your parents, you join the Marine Corps, which, by the way, is not the best idea, depending on the outcome. But I enjoyed my time in the Marine Corps. The way I got into the Marine Corps is I was on my way to a Charles Carroll lecture in college, and I took a wrong turn and ran into the Marine recruiter. And 6 months later, I was in Quantico at Officer Candidate School.
Looking back on it, how were you shaped by that experience of being in the Marines?
You know, it's funny. I can tell you, as someone who's been a young Marine and now older in my career, when you're in the Marine Corps and you meet former Marines, you just think they're old guys who are really not that relevant anymore. And when you leave, you almost disavow it. You don't really disavow it. Marines are always Marines. But when you leave, you want to put it behind you. And what you find is, as you traverse the time of your life and you get older, is the lessons you learn keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And it changes you in fundamental ways that you don't realize until you're older.
Give us an example of a couple, if you don't mind.
You know, at Intellidyne, the staff have a way of recording Tonyisms, and you find yourself repeating things or doing things that you learned as a young man. One of them, and your son will find this out pretty quickly. The Marine Corps has a saying called "Embrace the Suck," and it's essentially based on the fact that you're going to run 10 miles carrying 80 pounds, whether you like it or not. So you should embrace it, because when it's over, you'll feel better. Well, it's not that different in business. Business is about managed chaos, particularly in the federal market space. You never know what's going to happen. So you buckle down and you just watch what you're doing every day. And one day you look up and you're at the top of the mountain. Embracing the suck is a pretty good concept, and it works. In terms of leadership, I learned a long time ago the difference between management and leadership is that management is simply minimization of deviation from plan. Anybody can go to school to learn how to be a manager, but leadership is about developing a plan and inspiring people with that plan in such a way that they'll execute it as if it's their own. And that I learned in the Marine Corps. You don't manage somebody into a combat zone. You don't manage somebody up that hill. You can only lead up the hill, and that involves a number of attributes.
But there was one particular leadership trait that you took away from your Marine Corps experience.
Well, I think the most important thing for a leader is to have integrity. If you have integrity, people will follow you. If you're authentic, people will follow you. You can't lead from a book. You can't lead from a formula.
And you told us a funny story about, you know, how you saw that played out.
I'm trying to remember.
This is the Coke story.
Oh, yeah, that was actually, I'll tell you two because you reminded me of another one. But the funny one is when I was a young Marine in Officer Candidate School, because I'm an entrepreneur, I had an interesting way of making a little extra money. I would sneak out on Friday nights before Saturday's inspection, and I would go to the NCO club and stand in the shadows and buy sodas for a quarter. And then I would sell them to my fellow candidates for a dollar, and I'd have money to go on Liberty on Saturday. And one night I got caught, and I was asked if I had bought the sodas for myself or for others. And not wanting to get anybody else in trouble, I was steadfast in my claim that they were for me, wanting to be loyal. And the motto of the Marine Corps is Semper Fidelis, always faithful. And after about the third time I proclaimed that they were just for me and I was going to drink 14 sodas, I was made to drink all 14 sodas while I did push-ups and sit-ups over the course of about 6 hours. The other story, which is actually a better story about integrity, is I worked for I did a 2-year outside tour at the Marine Corps with the Naval, what is now Criminal Investigative Service, working on a criminal investigation in which an innocent captain who was a battery commander had people who worked for him committing a number of crimes for which he was totally unaware, and he had a choice. He had a choice to cover it up, or he had a choice to take responsibility for it and see that those people were prosecuted. And by taking the choice to do the right thing, he lost his Marine Corps career. He had to leave the Marine Corps, but he did the right thing.
And you you watched that happen.
I was there for the entire thing.
Yeah. What was that like for you to watch the guy be that? I mean, I'm sure he loved the Marine Corps and had to let it go.
I spend almost every November 10th with him. It's the Marine Corps birthday.
Yeah.
And I spend most of my Marine Corps birthdays with him. I wrote a letter to his son a couple of years later. He had a young son, to tell him what I thought of his father.
Wow.
Best Marine I ever served with.
So even though you didn't go to the family business to become an auto mechanic, you were around it enough to learn something about it. How did it shape you as a business leader?
Well, I learned, you know, the fixing a car and conducting business are really two separate activities. They're, you know, the billing, the selling, the advertising, those are all discrete from actually turning a wrench. And I was much better at that aspect of it. And I, my grandfather, who started the business, was an amazing businessman. My father was an amazing businessman. They were leaders. They were inspirational. Wherever they went, they always took over a room. And I found that wherever they went, when they took over a room, people wanted to come and do business with them. Because at the end of the day, if you have a choice between two vendors who are equally good, you're always going to go with the person you can affiliate with. And so learning to affiliate with people really became the motto that I tried to follow in my career.
Other than your family of origin and the impact that the Marine Corps had on you, what other important influences or people?
Well, when I worked at, I ran all the operations at Software AG Federal Systems for 6 years. I worked for an amazing guy named Dave Eves. Dave is my complete and total opposite in every way. I was a skinny, young, fast-talking former Marine from South Philadelphia, and Dave is a big, fat, introverted Texan. And wherever I would go, people would say, "You work for Dave Eves? He's a great guy. He fired me 3 years ago. Or you don't have any openings, do you?" He did everything and conducted himself in every way, not only with integrity, but with a feel for people. He really understood people, and he did it in such a way that he could fire you, he could counsel you, he could do all kinds of things to you, and you wouldn't even know.
I asked you in the green room if it was about the absence of fear or just a relationship to fear that allows you to be as fearless as you are in business, and you had a real good answer.
Well, for me, it's the absence of fear. I mean, what is the worst thing that can really happen? Look, I worry every day about the quality of life of the people who work for me. I have two constituencies in life. The people who have to go home and pay their tuitions and raise their kids and pay their mortgages, and my clients who expect great service from me. But the worst thing that's going to happen if I don't do my job is not going to be, no one's going to die. And fearing failure is, I think, the surest way to fail. You have to embrace the goal and be willing to give up whatever it takes to get to the goal. So there really isn't a lot of fear in doing this, because the worst thing that's going to happen is you'll just get another chance to do it again.
Right. What's your proudest moment up till now?
I just recently received a letter from a retired naval officer. In the last government shutdown, I'm sure you're aware of the impact it had on federal employees. 800,000 federal employees, but what they don't tell you is that there were several million contractor employees.
Right.
And guess what? When the government employees got paid back, the contractors didn't. Well, we sat down as a group at Intellidyne, and I sat with my CFO and said, "I have 130 hours of leave that I'm not planning on taking. Can we put that in a bank for those people?" And that one act inspired the rest of the management team to put 600 hours in, and the rest of the company to put 1,500 hours in.
Wonderful. What's the website address for the company?
www.intellidyne-llc.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Tony Crescenzo, who's the CEO of Intellidyne. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Joanne Wallace, the president and CEO of National Legal Aid Defender Association; Jonathan Neal, the owner and president of Metropolitan Moving and Storage; Dusty Wentz, the founder and CEO of Knowledge Consulting Group; and finally, once again, Tony Crescenzo, who's the CEO of Intellidyne. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com, or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions.